first a few psukim, a number of psukim actually, 15 or 20 of the Parshas Chayesara, devoted to Avram's procurement of a burial place for Sarah. And I'd like to take a look actually at three or four words in the beginning of the parsha, which may not seem to us to be necessarily so prominent, but nonetheless, as we'll see, there's quite a bit to say about them. And that is in Perek Kaf Gimel Pasuk Gimel. So the pasuk reads, "Vayakam Avraham al pnei meisos." So Avraham arises from his deceased. "Vayidaber al pnei ches lemor." As we know, his negotiations take place through pnei ches, headed by Ephron, each one more dubious than the other, and Avraham has to deal with them. And the words that I wanted to devote some attention to are the words "Vayidaber al pnei ches lemor." Seemingly, that just describes him talking. But the background to our inquiry here is that we know that the words Dibur and Amira have quite different connotations. This is something that Rashi mentions a number of places in his Perush throughout the Torah. So that Dibur, and this is the Gemara says in Makos and Daf Yud Aleph, Dibur is Lashon Kosher, it represents kind of a harsher way of talking. Amira, it's Amira Raka, it's a more pleasant and easygoing way of speaking, to the extent that from a certain point of view, if we are medactic, Vaidaber el b'nei ches lemor seems to be almost a contradiction in terms, because he's either speaking to them in a Dibur type of way, which is harsh, or in a Amira type of way, which is more amiable and more pleasant. But how do the two go together? So I thought perhaps, one may suggest, that the resolution could be based on Rashi. Rashi's comment on the very next pasuk. Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. I'm a sojourner, I'm a dweller with you. And those are Avram's introductory words as he asks for a plot for Sarah. Now actually, ger v'toshav, again, are two terms which have slightly or somewhat distinct connotations and perhaps even contrasting connotations. For as we know, ger refers to someone who is either transient or lightweight or temporary, and toshav is someone who's established and prominent. So a ger is not a toshav, and a toshav is not a ger. And Avram says he's both. Now, Rashi himself says that on a pshat level, it's a transition, as if to say, I began as a ger and became a toshav, so that the two represent two different time frames, and he's just introducing his background. But then, Rashi is not content, seemingly, entirely with the pshat approach, and Rashi quotes Medrash HaGadah. What is ger and what is toshav? Says Rashi, there's two possibilities, two ways this can play out. Imtirtzu, if you like, and if you're amenable to it, hareini ger, I can act as a ger, as if to say I'm prepared to be treated as someone who has no rights, but I'll pay for the plot if necessary. Ve'im lav, but if you cause trouble, eye toshav betlenu min adin, if you refuse under all circumstances, so that I will invoke my rights as a toshav, because the truth is the land is mine. Rashi quotes the pasuk where Hashem says he'll give the land to Avram's descendants, which actually is interesting because more to the point, one could say Avram has already been given the land himself, as we spoke about. But nonetheless, these are the two ways. And therefore, in a sense, we see that by presenting the two possibilities, Avram is speaking on the one hand in an Amira type of way, pleasant, I'm not demanding anything, I'm happy to pay for it. But then also in the background is this harsher subtext, whereby if we don't come to any arrangement, I'll take it min adin, which is a much more strident approach, a unilateral approach. And therefore one could say that these two approaches are, which will be outlined in Pasuk Dalet, are introduced by the Torah in Pasuk Gimel, where it says, Vayidaber itam lemor. We have an aspect of Dibur, and an aspect of Amira, a harsher and a softer. And the point is, Avram only mentions plan B of acting as a Toshav in order to encourage them to relate to him as a ger. And therefore, Vayidaber Itam Lemor. He has this harsh element to what he's saying in order to lead to a pleasant outcome, as if to say, let's not go there, but we will if there's no other opportunity. But the ideal is that we should work things out amiably. That the Dibor and what it represents should lead to Amira. But it occurred to me that perhaps there's more to these words, Vayidaber al b'nei ches lemor, than what we have said. And the background to this, for I believe that there's room to say that these words are actually motif words in the Parsha. They really set the scene for, or the atmosphere for what the Parsha is about. There's a very interesting position which is adopted by some commentators, notably among them Rabbeinu Yonah, the cousin of Ramban, in his Perush to Pirkei Avos. And Pirkei Avos talks about, or mentions, references the Asara Nisyonos, Shenisnasa Avram Avinu, the 10 trials of Avram. And once the Mishnah references it, then the Mefarshim discuss them and discuss what they are. And interestingly, not all Mefarshim agree as to what was number 1 and what was number 10. The consensus, one would say, or the commonly accepted approach, is that the final Nisoyon was Nisoyon of the Akedah. However, Rabbeinu Yonah is of the opinion that the Akedah was Nisoyon number 9. There was a 10th Nisoyon after that, and that 10th Nisoyon was the burial of Sarah. Now, this approach certainly requires some reflection. After all, with all due respect and with all due understanding and consideration of the difficulties of burying Sarah, it's difficult to understand how it could rate as an Nisoyon. When we consider the others, I mean, it's unfortunate and it's part of life and it's not easy, but to be in that bracket called Nisyonos, and there's only 10, even though Avram did more than 10 good deeds in his life, so clearly there's something very special about these 10. And moreover, if we may crystallize the question somewhat, not only do we need to understand how it's one of the Nisyonos, we need to understand how it's... Because one could only assume, I think it's fair to say, that the Nisyonos were in increasing order of difficulty, which means that now one needs to say not only that it qualified, but it is the most qualified, more so than the Akedah. And that, of course, is very difficult, because it's hard to understand how burying Sarah with all that difficulty would be harder than being prepared to kill Yitzhak. Clearly, there is an aspect of burying Sarah where Avram was not yet tested, and that's why it takes place as number 10, but we need to find out what that is. There's a very important comment, I believe, in the Parish of the Ksava Kabbalah of Yaakov zu Mecklenburg, in the beginning of Parshas Va'era, and he talks about the concept of Dibor, which we referenced. Dibor is Lashon Kasha, Dibor always represents something harsh, and his question is, why is it so? I mean, is there something about the root letters, Dalet, Beis, Reish, and when you just see those letters, are they harsh letters as opposed to Amira? How do these two words come to have these two different connotations? Well, the Ksava Kabbalah says that the root of the matter, pardon the expression, is not so much a question of the letters Dibor versus the letters of Amira, but rather the way the word is constructed. Because it's interesting to note that a bit of basic grammar, ledaber, is not the same construct as lomar. Lomar, or lemor, is what we call a kal. It's straightforward, very simple. Ledaber is what belongs to the family called PL. And PL is intensive. And whenever a word is in part of that intensive family, there's something intense about it. And sometimes you find root letters can belong to either. Classic example, there is lishbor and lishaber. And because there's two different ways for things to get broken. I mean, there's more than two, but there's two general classifications. Lishbor is to break. And the shaber is to smash. The different coloring entirely. Similarly, therefore, so the Ksava Kabbalah, it's true, the Gemara does say that Vayidaber is always harsh. But the reason why is not because Dalet based race means harsh, but because it's typically a PL, it's intensive. And generally, all things being equal, the person is under a normal frame of mind. If they exert no effort, they speak pleasantly. And if they wish to speak harshly, so it's a much more intense experience. And therefore, the harshness is the result of the intensity. And the pleasantness is the result of the lack of intensity. And that's all things being equal. That's how each one will find its place. That is why Dibur is Loshen Kosher, because the intensity tends to lead to that harsher type of tone. And it's for that reason, says the Ksava Kabbalah, that we should not be surprised that sometimes the term dibur and vayidaber is specifically employed for a pleasant outcome. Because sometimes it requires effort to bring a pleasant outcome. You find whenever you're looking to comfort someone or persuade them or bring them out of a difficult situation, that's always called ledaber al libam. So, and therefore, as the Navi Yishaya says, Dabru Alev Yerushalayim. Dabru Alev Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim has had enough tzaras. She doesn't need any more harsh words. This is Nachamu Nachamu. This is to comfort Yerushalayim. But how do you comfort her? It's not easy. She's not amenable to being comforted. But, so you have to exert effort. Dabru Alev Yerushalayim. Make an effort and bring her out. And bring her to a state of comfort. And thus you find when we appreciate what lies at the heart of Dibur being harsh, it's really the intensity, then in an obverse situation, you may need intensity to lead to a pleasant outcome. And that we may find the other side of the coin to this as well. Not only can Dibur sometimes have a pleasant outcome because it requires intensity, sometimes Amira can have an unpleasant outcome, even though it's officially a very pleasant term. Where do I see this? And I have not seen the Mefarshim comment on this. Rashi says something. I need to keep looking, because I haven't seen anyone who raises this question. In Parshas Bereishis, when it comes to Cain and Hevel, and they have their tensions between them, and Cain is feeling very badly towards Hevel, and the pasuk which describes him killing Hevel says, "Vayomer Cain el Hevel achir." Cain said something to Hevel, and we don't even know what that thing is. And Rashi comments there. It's very vague. This pasuk. He said to Hevel, "What did he say?" We don't know. Rashi says, "Nichnas imo." B'divrei riv u'matzah. The word matzah actually is a word in Lashon HaKodesh for argument. He got into an argument with him. Kidei lehisolel alav lehargo, in order to have then a pretext to kill him. It's a very interesting thing to consider. Cain has decided to kill Hevel, but he can't bring himself to do it in cold blood. But he is prepared to warm up his blood. And then he'll kill him. And he arranges that. So on the one hand, he's behind the whole thing, but that doesn't mean that he can dispense with it, because he needs to get into the heat of the moment, although he provides the heat of the moment by getting into an argument with Hevel. And indeed, with these words, Rashi actually has addressed the question as to why the Pasuk doesn't say what he says. Because since whatever he said was a pretext to get into an argument, the pasuk doesn't even mention what he says because it doesn't matter. It's incidental. There's nothing Hevel could have said that could not have provoked an argument in Cain. It's that type of situation, which means that you can fill in the blank because it doesn't matter what he said. If he said something else, the result would have been the same, because Cain is looking to get into an argument with him to kill him in the heat of the moment. Now, thus far, Rashi's comment, but I have a simple question, and that is, if these words represent Cain getting into an argument with Hevel to the extent that he wants to kill him, why are they introduced with the words Vayomer Cain el Hevel achiv? Did we not learn, and will Rashi himself not tell us, that Amira Vayomer is always something pleasant? But this is anything but pleasant. How can an argument be introduced to the words Vayomer? Indeed, I would mention parenthetically that the Vilna Gaon, in his Pirush Aderes Elio to Bereishis, actually explains the opposite to Rashi, and for this reason, namely that as a way of being enabling himself to kill Hevel, he actually spoke to him very nicely, in order that Hevel should not see it coming, in order that he should drop his guard, because he began a friendly conversation and Hevel thought everything was fine, then he killed him. Apparently, he did not rate his chances if Hevel's guard was up. So he dealt with that. He disarmed him by being nice to him. That is in keeping with Vayomer. It was very devious on his part, but that's what Vayomer is. And yet Rashi says exactly the opposite. That, as we said, Direi Umatza, words of argument. How can Amira lead to argument? I think, based on the Ksava Kabbalah, we can understand. Because if you are angry with a person enough to kill them, it's actually much easier to get into an argument with them than it is to be nice to them. Which means that if Amira always represents the presence, as we know, sometimes when A is in a bad mood with B, it's the easier option to react badly and to take offense and to become angry at anything, really. A question as innocuous as what's the weather like or anything, or how are you, is already a trigger. And that's why the pasuk said that the way that Cain felt towards Hevel, it was an amira. So it was the shortest path between two points. It didn't require any intensity at all on his part. The intensity, on the contrary, would have been to calm down and to restore a good feeling. But to stay in a state of bad feeling, that's called amira in that situation. So these are some illustrations and applications of, in a sense, the broader understanding of Dibor versus amira. It's intensity versus less intensity. And with this in mind, let us come back to Rebbe Yonah's comment, his very startling comment, that the 10th Nisayon was none other than the burial of Sarah. How could it be? As we mentioned, it must be that there's something about Avram that's being tested that's never been tested before. On the one hand, of course, it doesn't get greater than the Akedah, it doesn't get more difficult than the Akedah, it's something that Avram had to be prepared to do, and he was prepared to do it, as we discussed last week, as we see from the Pesukim. But that was done, and it was a stunning success, and Avram comes home, and everything crashes. Because he comes home and he finds that Sarah's dead, and he may or may not know that this was somehow indirectly connected to the Akedah itself. Which means all the feelings of euphoria and all the feelings of success and jubilation are dissipated. And he's just left drained. And now what? And now Avram has to deal with a bunch of pirates who are looking to take advantage of him. And what is the Nisayon here? The Nisayon here, as Rav Dessler explains in the Sefer Michtav Melio, is without an ounce of motivation to do so from any type of mood, Avram needs to conduct himself with grace and with patience and with courtesy. And we see how the pasuk devotes much attention. There's many details that are given. Every two or three psukim, someone's bowing down to someone else and they're being courteous to each other. And that's the way you need to deal with people, regardless of how you feel and regardless of who they are in terms of your interaction with them. And that's a nisayon. And it's such a different type of nisayon. It's almost like the anticlimactic Nisayon to the Akedah. It's the anti-Akedah, but from a certain point of view, that makes it a harder Nisayon to pass, and for Avram not to in any way show irritation or impatience, and that's the Nisayon. And as we see, Avram passes. But I believe, based on our discussion, we may say that Avram's approach here is summed up in these words, Vayidaber al b'nei ches lemor. Because the intensity that Avram needs to inject into the situation and the effort that he needs to invest in this circumstance is in order to produce a pleasant outcome. Because Avram, if he didn't do that, it would not be pleasant and he would not be speaking to them in this pleasant way. But that's the Nisayon. And therefore all of his dibor and all of his investment is towards les morts. Speak to them with due courtesy, with due consideration, and etiquette, and all of those trappings of the way that one is meant to speak to people. So I think that's quite a bit to ponder with regards to, as I said, these words which would seem to be merely joining words, but not really the happening words, and yet there's plenty happening there. Now, when it comes to Ephron, as we know, he's very grandiose, and he offers everything, and then and he makes you pay for it. In Pasuk Yud Aleph, he says he's going to give the whole field, and the deviousness of Ephron is that since he says he's giving it, he can say he gives the cave and the whole field, because he's giving. You can't stop him from giving. But since Avram knows he's going to have to pay, he's going to have to pay for everything that Ephron said that he would give. And Ephron, of course, will protest, but he doesn't mean to protest, and Avram realizes that. And therefore he takes the famous Arba Meos Shekel Kesef, and that's in Pasuk Tet Zayin. Perek Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Tet Zayin. Vayishma Avraham El Ephron. Avram hears Ephron, and of course the irony is he hears him loud and clear. That's the point. He understands exactly what Ephron means to say. Vayishkol Avram Le Ephron Esakesef Ashedi Bebaz Nevenechez. And he pays out to Avram the money that Ephron had very grandly announced to the entire Bnei Chez, which means they'll remember the sum of 400 shekels. They won't necessarily remember that Ephron said that he wouldn't take it. They'll just remember that there was 400 shekels discussed, which means they'll be wondering why Avram didn't pay, if he doesn't pay. That's part of the whole situation. Avram Meir Shekel Kesef Over Lasocher. And Rashi has an interesting comment with regards to Ephron's name. Because in this pasuk, Ephron, although normally it's written Male, that is to say, Ayin Pei Resh Vav Nun, Male, that's his name. But in this pasuk, it's written without the Vav, Ayin Pei Resh Nun. And Rashi says, Chaser Vav, Ephron. And what do we learn from the fact that it's missing the Vav? Lefisha Omar Harber, he said a lot, but Finu Ma'at Lo Asa, he said he would do a great deal, he didn't do anything in the end. He didn't give him anything. He said he'd give him everything, and in the end, Avram had to pay for everything. It's interesting that Rashi comments on Ephron's name being written without a Vav. Does Rashi always comment if a person's name is without a Vav? Here, there's certainly room to do so, for a number of reasons. Ephron's name has been mentioned numerous times, each time with a Vav. That being the case, it makes it quite a glaring anomaly, a departure for this one time for it to be written without a vav. Rashi has to comment. Secondly, Ephron's name has already been mentioned, or more correctly, Ephron has already been mentioned by name in this very pasuk. If we go back to the beginning, Vayishma Avraham El Ephron, and the very next words, Vayishgol Avraham Le Ephron. But as we know, within one pasuk, it's perfectly acceptable. If you just mention the two people involved, you can then move to pronouns. Avram heard Ephron, and he paid him, etc. And therefore, reiterating in such close proximity the Ephron's name, and now it's written without a vav, that says Darshani. I mean, that basically tells you that you should notice the fact that the vav is missing. And the question is, what does this teach us? Ephron is the classic example of what one should avoid, which is Omer Harbeh v'apilu ma'at einoseh. What we're recommended to do is Emor ma'at v'aseh harbeh. Say little and do a lot. Always under-promise and over-deliver. Whereas Ephron over-promises and doesn't deliver at all. And what's very interesting is, it seems that these two are perhaps not necessarily causationally connected, as if to say, because he's Ephron, so it's in his nature to talk a lot, and in his nature to do nothing, and when you put those two aspects of his nature together, he talks a lot and does nothing. But interestingly, the Mashgiach of Mir, Rabbi Ruchem Leibovitz, the famous Rabbi Ruchem, he says something very, very thought-provoking here. And that is, we say that Ephron, he said a lot, and did a little, and we're encouraged in Pirkei Avos, Emor Ma'at Va'aseh Harbeh. These two things are related. How so? There come certain situations where a person feels he should do something, or he should do the right thing, or he should act in whatever direction. And he's, in a sense, not comfortable with himself not doing that. But there is a certain device that can allow him to ease his comfort, and that is by talking about it, by saying that he'll do it. Because for him, he's given some expression, even though it's verbal expression, and actually the verbal expression is of something that he will follow through then in the realms of action, but he's already been yotze, so to speak. In other words, he's not prepared to do nothing, so what does he do? He does something. He talks about it. And that's his contribution. And therefore, saying a lot can sometimes lead to a person doing nothing. Because if he didn't say anything, he's got to do something. But now that he said everything, he feels like he's already done it.
Draco.
Yeah. And Lamasho, someone that they're by themselves, people should visit them. And one of those people is oneself, and one knows it. So to say nothing is very uncomfortable. But sometimes when people say, "Oh, I really must go and visit them," with that they've been yotze, and then they never go. And that's Omer Harber, which enables the person thereby to do nothing. And that's really the deeper understanding of the problem with Ephraim. He probably felt that he'd done a heroic deed that day by offering 400 shekels worth of land for free, and not connecting it with the fact that he actually took the 400 shekels because his part was done. It's interesting, therefore, that the letter that is missing from Ephraim's name is the letter Vav. I'm not sure what the alternatives are, so obviously one has to proceed with discretion. It's clearly the easiest letter to go missing. But nonetheless, the letter Vav, and Vav is a hook, Vav is a link. It's how A leads to B through the Vav. And in a sense, what should happen is that a person's intentions should then be followed through with an action. However, the Vav goes missing by talking about it. That actually short circuits, in a sense, or frustrates the process of A leading to B, because it all remains within A, because it's almost like it's done already through the big speech. And therefore, with a lack of a connector, the connecting letter in Ephraim's name is the one that goes missing. Now, the central parts, almost all of the parsha really relates to the quest for a wife for Yitzchak. Avram sends Eliezer, and he tells him, "You can't take from Beno Sechnani, you've got to go back to where I come from and get a wife from there." And if we take a look at a couple of the psukim here, which are in Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Hey, Eliezer raises a seemingly pertinent question, fair question. And that is, Vayomer lach ha'evet, ulai lo tevah ha'ishal aleches acharai. Perhaps she won't want to come back with me. Ela aretz hazos. Sheva sheva bincha. So should I take Yitzchak back? And Avram says no. He says, "Your due diligence, and you are bound by an oath by me to do your best. To go there, to meet with them, put the situation to them." But he says, as we move towards Pasuk Ches, but if she doesn't want to come, so then you're free. You're clear from the Shavua. Now the question is, well, if you're clear from the Shavua, it's all very nice that you're clear from the Shavua, but Yitzchak still needs to get married. And the ones that we're looking for are not forthcoming, so then what? Is there a plan B? Rashi comments on the words v'nikisa mishkuasi, etc. V'kach lo isha mi benos aner eshkol umamri. If it doesn't work out with the people back in Haran, and that's not happening, then plan B is to take a wife from the daughters of either aner eshkol umamri, who are well known as quality people. Bali Bris Avram, they're not his first choice, but they are his second choice. Now, interestingly, in Mefarshei Rashi ask, how does Rashi see this? I mean, all the pasuk says is you've got to go there, and if you don't go there, you're free. If you're free, seemingly all bets are off. Anything can happen. How does Rashi know that even as, or why does Rashi feel that it's pertinent to comment that if it's not from Haran, it doesn't mean anywhere, it's not Hefker, it's not from anywhere in Canaan, specifically from these three? Is this Rashi's intuition or just what seems reasonable? Clearly not, because it's a comment on the Pasuk. Somehow it's latent within the Pasuk. But where? It just says you're absolved from the Shavua. Well, the Mizrahi says, Rabbi Nido Mizrahi, the foremost commentator on Rashi, if you look at Rashi's, at Avram's words in Pasuk Gimel, let's go back to Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Gimel, where he adjures Eliezer with this Shavua. La'ashbiacha, I will place an oath on you by Shem Elokei Shamayim Elokei Aretz, Asher lo tikachi sholevni. Do not take a wife for my son, Mibnos HaKanani, Asher Anochi Yoshev Bekirbo, from the daughters of the Kanani, in whose midst I dwell. And the Mizrahi raises a simple question, and that is, Avram lives in Canaan, which means that, having said, don't take from the daughters of Canaan, we know to whom he is referring. He doesn't need to then further specify, Asher Anochi Yoshev Bekirbo. If he dwells in the midst of Canaan, and he said, don't take from Canaan, that don't take from the people in whose midst he dwells. Why then does Avram add the words, Asher Anochi Yoshev Bekirbo? And that's why Mizrahi says that there is a further accentuating happening here, whereby when Avram begins to say, do not take from Benos Canaan, it means Benos Canaan generally. But one may think, well, you know, there are some seemingly quality people who would be good candidates for Yitzchak. Namely, honor Eshkol Umamre. They're Baalei Bris Avram. They're quality people. And that's why Avram continues and further explicates, Asher Anochi Yoshev Bekirbo, meaning, and in whose midst I dwell? In whose midst does he dwell, specifically? He dwells together with Honor Eshkol Umamrim. That's right, they're his circle. And therefore what he means to say is, do not take from Canaan generally, and do not even take from those among Canaan with whom I dwell specifically. Honor Eshkol Umamrim. But once that's true, and we see in the sense it reaches a point, it narrows towards a very specific group, that's why Rashi said that if it doesn't work out in Haran, and then one defaults back to Canaan, it's not to Canaan generally, but it's specifically to those who Avram mentioned as the even, not them, for plan A, but they and only they are plan B. Benos Oner Eshkol Umamre, Ha'am Asher Anuchi Yoshev Bekirbo. And interestingly, the Bartanura, who, as we mentioned in the past, he's famous for his Perush on the Mishnayos, but he also has a brief set of comments on Rashi's Perush on the Torah, and Bartanura says that there's a further point here. Because actually, Avram's words in Pasuk Ches, again, she doesn't want to come, V'nikisa mishvuasi zos, you will be absolved from this Shavua. Now, the question is, well, how many Shavuas are there? I mean, there's only one. Just say, V'nikisa mishvuasi, you're absolved of the Shavua. But he doesn't say you're absolved of the Shavua. He says you're absolved of this one. That implies that perhaps there was more than one Shavua. But how so? We're only aware of the one in Pasuk Dalet. Says the Bartanura, these two groups, Kanani generally, and his circle specifically, Asher Anochi Yoshev Bekirbo, constitute essentially two separate Shavuos, or two separate branches of a Shavua, two separate segments of the Shavua. And that's why when Avram says, if she doesn't come back from Haran, you will be absolved, but not of the Shavua in its entirety, or not of both aspects of the Shavua, but rather this aspect of the Shavua. Mishvuasi Zos means the most recently mentioned, the specific group of Aner Eshkol Umamre. So that's where Rashi sees in the Pasuk that the default is to this group specifically. Okay. However, there is a follow-up to this. Because as we know, not only does the Torah tell us in great detail everything that happens to Eliezer, but then the Torah tells us how Eliezer told them in great detail everything that happened to him. And thus is Parshas Chayesara a good 20 psukim longer. Yafa Sichosam, shall have the others. And therefore, there's another comment of Rashi. And this is in Pasuk Memtes. Perek Kaftala Pasuk. That's a long perek here. They had Rachmanas, so they broke the perek. We couldn't take the suspense. So it doesn't finish until Rivka comes back. Pasuk Memtes. So much has happened. Rivka's passed the test. Eliezer's told the story. And now it's the time. It's the reckoning. The time for them to make a decision. Vata. Im yeshchem osim chesed ve'emes es adudi hagiduli. If you're prepared to do chesed ve'emes, and it's a very blended message that Eliezer is saying. Chesed, of course, you're very kind, but emes, meaning she's obviously the one for Yitzhak, so that those two go together. It's very nice of you to agree, but you have to agree. I mean, it's clearly destiny. Clearly, min hashamayim. Hagiduli, tell me. Ve'im lo, and if not, hagiduli, also tell me. Ve'efne al yamin o al smol. And then I'll pursue some other course. I'll turn to the right, I'll turn to the left. So, of course, Rashi wants to know who's to the right and who's to the left. I mean, everyone wants to know. And Rashi comments, Al-Yamin is Mibnos Yishmael. The Al-Samol is Mibnos Lot. Shiyoshev L'smolo Shel Avram. Lot lives to the left, that is to say, to the south of Avram. In Tanakh, everyone's always considered to be facing east. Right and left, or north and south. Okay. Now, so of course, what's very interesting is we find new options that we never really discussed before. We just figured out how it could be that if it doesn't work out with her, whoever she is, then who are the candidates? Onar Eshkol Mamre. And yet Eliezer doesn't mention Onar Eshkol Mamre. He mentions a new group called the Daughters of Yishmael or the Daughters of Lot. I mean, where are they coming from? And why does he mention this? And Mefarshi Rashi explained, the reason why Eliezer specifically makes mention of the daughters of Lot or the daughters of Yishmael as the alternative is because he is dedicated to securing Rivka as the wife for Yitzhak. Now, it's very clear to him and providence that she is the one. However, she has a family, which sometimes happens, and he senses that they're somewhat difficult. They could raise difficulties, especially as, and if the understanding is, of course, we're Avram's family, you've got to keep it in the family. But once they feel that they have almost like they are the exclusive candidate, they can make trouble. Because if you feel you're the only choice, then your terms have no limit. And that's why, on the one hand, and this is a very delicate part of the proceedings, of the negotiation, Eliezer is very encouragingly tell them how important they are as family, but he is also telling them that they are not the only family of Avram. As if to say, family is important, and you're first, but there's other branches, there's Benos Yishmael, there's Benos Lot. I came to you first, but I do have second and third. And that's why he emphasizes this, so for them to realize they have to chaperayim, as they say in Aram Naharayim. Now, so the question is, and this in a sense is one of the most fascinating questions, where is this coming from? Where does Eliezer get license to say this? Avram never mentioned it. Avram spoke about Onar Eshkol Mamre. He may feel that they won't be much moved by Onar Eshkol Mamre. They're like, you know, barley bris is one thing, but, you know, blood is thicker than water. So he mentioned this other group. But who entitled him to do that? But where is he getting that from? Is that a real option? And here it seems that opinion is divided amongst Mefarshi Rashi. Avram never mentions his family at all, seemingly. Because if we look at Avram's instructions, which we spoke about, Asher lo tikach isha b'vusa kanani, and then Pasuk Dalet says, Ki im el artziva o el moladati. You've got to go back to my land and to my birthplace. That's it. If you go back to my land and your birth and my birthplace, find someone from there. Who? Anyone. From Avram's family? Not necessarily, as we know. But it is also true that Eliezer, in a sense, tweaks that. And as he quotes, so to speak, Avram's words, he says, Avram told me that you can't take from the Kanani. You've got to go El Mishparti the Abay Savi. Sorry, Abay Savi the Mishparti. You've got to go to my father's house, to my family. So Eliezer tells them that Avram wanted to go to the family. Is that true? Has he completely deviated from what Avram said? Avram spoke about location. Eliezer spoke about family. Are they two different things? Some say yes. But the Maharal in Gur Arye says no. Actually, Avram did tell him to go to the family. And the critical word here is the word moladati. For what does moladati mean? We normally translate moladati to mean my birthplace. However, says Maharal, if you look in Rashi elsewhere, you'll see that he explains, or can explain, the word moladati to mean my family. What's the case in point? When Parshas Mikates, when Yaakov's sons, Yaakov says, why did you tell Yosef so, he didn't know he's Yosef, why did you tell that person so much information about yourself? And they said, he was asking us questions the whole time. Sha'ol sha'al lanu ha'ish, sha'ol sha'al ha'ish, lanu ulam moladateinu. He asked us questions about ourselves and about moladateinu. Says Rashi, moladateinu means mishpachteinu. He asked questions about our family, the brothers, who, where they're from, etc. And therefore you see that Rashi actually understands moladati not so much to be reference to a place, but actually to a group of people. Moladati is a watchword for mishpachti. And therefore, in the analysis of the Maharal, and it's a very important point and convincing evidence that he brings from that Rashi in Mikates, when Avram says to go to Arzi El Moladati, he's giving him two parameters. Number one is location, called Arzi, but within that location, called Moladati. Therefore, says Gur Arye, when the point of Eliezer, and that's why once she was from Avram's family, and Eliezer said that I was told to go to Avram said to go to his father's house. He did. That's what moladati means. He was told to go to his father's house. And what does he mean, therefore, with this plan of plan A and plan B? Says Gur Arye, ideally both criteria should be fulfilled. Number one, she should be from Artsy, from that location, Haran. And number two, from Moladati, from my family. However, says Eliezer, you're the only group that fits both of those, because you're the only ones from Avram's land and also his family. However, if you refuse, I will have no choice but to default to one of those criteria, and the primary one being family, being Moladati. He has family back home. His ideal family is from this location, but it's not his only family. And therefore, according to the Maharal, everything that Eliezer said is actually contained within Avram's original words. It's a question of what he accentuates in terms of his discussions with them. And therefore, when Avram says if she doesn't want to come, then go to honor Eshkol Mamre, that means if none of the family is forthcoming, then you've got to go outside the family. But first choice, first second choice is yet inside the family. However, not all Mefarshim and not all Mefarshi Rashi understand that what when Avram says Arti Omeladati, he's referring to family. They understand that it's about location purely, which means Avram never spoke about his family. Eliezer emphasized the family because, well, that's what you do when you're talking to the family. And but what that means is that he invoked something of a license, servant's license, to see things through. And he emphasized something that Avram didn't really mention at all, because he senses that if he doesn't mention it, if they feel that they're incidental, the family connection is incidental, well, family doesn't like to feel that way. And therefore he mentions it. But therefore, not only, and this is a whole different perspective on Eliezer's repetition, it's not a repetition anymore. It's a retelling, and it's a revised telling. Says Maskil David, part of the revised telling is who is plan B. In other words, since family was never really a primary concern, she just needs to be from Haran. Doesn't matter if it's from family or not. And if Haran doesn't work out, then Arnash Gula Mamre, who's also not family. But once Eliezer, for reasons that he feels are necessary, emphasizes the importance of family, so if family is critical for plan A, it's also critical for plan B. And that's why he mentions now as the alternatives, other family, Benos Yishmael, and Benos Lo. But Avram never said that. And more to the point, says Matthew and David, Avram probably wouldn't agree for reasons that are not very difficult to understand. Because should we ask, why does Avram not take a wife for Yitzhak from Benos Yishmael and Benos Lot? The answer simply is, read about them and you'll see. But of course, Eliezer knows that Lavan doesn't know anything about not Yishmael and not Lot. He just knows that he has daughters and therefore they're candidates. If he ever met Yishmael, he'd know that Yishmael's not a candidate. And if he ever met Lot, he'd know that Lot is not a candidate. But he doesn't. And therefore, he's able to have them as these options which are perhaps undermine the confidence of as Lavan and the family as the exclusive choices. So this is a very interesting discussion because it turns out that this is actually a progression of Eliezer fabricating essentially the primacy of family, which was never an issue at all, and therefore as he presents family as important for Lavan, the alternatives are also in terms of family, Al-Yamin or Al-Smal. But a very interesting question to ponder, as almost like as a postscript, and that is if we go back to the source of Rashi's comment, which is Pasuk Memtes, where he says, if you're going to do the right thing, tell me, and not, if not, then also tell me. And Rashi says that that refers to the daughters of Lot and the daughters of Yishmael. Or were you daughters of Yishmael and daughters of Lot? And the point is, as Mefarshi Rashi have said, he wants to emphasize this other family. So the simple question is, what did Eliezer actually say? We know what the Pasuk says, and we know how Rashi explains it. But the question is, what did Eliezer say? And the background to that question is, if we take the simple linear approach, that the Pasuk says, quotes him as saying, Efne al-Yamin al-Smal, I'll turn to the right or to the left. Which means apparently Eliezer said, I'll turn to the right or to the left. What's that meant to mean? To Lavan and Besua? To the right and to the left. Who's to the right? Whoever's to the right. And to the left, whoever's to the left. Anyone in particular, whatever that means. In other words, it doesn't sound like it's referring to specific people. It certainly doesn't sound like it's referring to specific people that they've never heard of before. So it's very difficult if the goal is, in a sense, to undermine their sense of the proprietal sense of the shidduch here by saying that there's other family. You're not telling them there's other family by using the terms right and left, because right and left doesn't refer to family. It refers to the directions of right and left. Now it happens to be that to the right is Yishmael. How does it go? Al-Yamin is Yishmael, and to the left is Lot. That may well be. But how likely is that the Lavan and Basul will understand its reference to them? Not only will they need to have heard for them, they need to know where they live, geographically, relative to Avraham Avinu, which is highly unlikely, because there's been no contact between the family. And Lot and the Yishmael are not such a goyse gedula that the news travels about them. There's not really much to write home about. That's very interesting, because it's not an effective deterrent if you just say Yamin or Smol, unless you present them those words with Rashi's commentary. The alternative, perhaps, is that actually what Eliezer says is that there's other family. In other words, he spoke to them about Yishmael and Lot. No doubt he didn't tell them the whole story, but he mentioned their name. And the pasuk then refers to that with the terms Yamin and Smol. Each of these possibilities is very intriguing for its own way, because really what that means is either the Torah quotes Eliezer verbatim, which makes it difficult to understand how they worked out what he meant to say, or alternatively, after that actually, no, his words were one thing, but the Torah formats what he said for the Torah's purposes, because there's other things to learn from what Eliezer said, in addition to whatever he was saying to Moshe Lavan and the soul. So that's a very interesting idea to follow up. This mention, it's occurred to me literally just now, although it will not be our discussion, but there's a famous further other alternative as to who should marry Yitzhak. That how many other people can there be? But it's actually with Eliezer's daughter. And as we know, the Rashi comments on it again in Eliezer's retelling, because it's another one of those missing letters, missing vavs, actually. Ulai is written as Eli. Perhaps she'll marry me. If I'm never to be married to my family, Yitzhak will marry my daughter. But it's interesting to see, and of course Mefarshim raised the question, and the Medrash actually makes this comment on when Eliezer actually first says it. Rashi delays it, as far as I remember. Because Mefarshim do raise the question, is it not a fair question? Is it not appropriate? I mean, to not upset anything? So he has to say something, which means, how do you know there's more to it than that? Maybe he's just asking because he needs to ask. But if you look at the words again, Pasuk, hey, Vayomer Eilav Ha'Eved, Ulai Lo Tiva Hishal Alecha Sacharai Ela Artzadot. What if she doesn't want to come back here? Ha'ar Sheva Shevet Bincha Ela Artzashiyat Sosna Misham. Now, as if to say, if plan A, which is for her to come back here, doesn't work out, what about this idea of him going there? But the question is, or the observation is, it doesn't seem from the pasuk that Eliezer is interested in that happening. And the way we see that is, look at the way that he describes the place. He describes it as a place that surely this would not happen. As if to say, maybe she won't want to come after me, so why not just say, should I then take your son there? But he doesn't say that. He doesn't say there. He says, Hey, Ashivas Bincha, should I take your son? El Ha'aret Asher Yotzasa Misham, to the land which you left. And by mentioning the Haran as the land that Abraham left, Eliezer is clearly indicating that it shouldn't happen. It wouldn't work. So the alternative he's presenting in a way where it probably won't work, which means there's a third alternative that no one's really ever speaking about, and that is the alternative of Eliezer's daughter. Perhaps that's part of the equation. Just a final comment. If we take a look at the bracha that Lavan and his mother give to Rivka, and that is, it became very famous. They give it under the chuppah. He had mazel. In Pasuk Nuntes, sorry, Pasuk Samach, Pirkei Kaftala Pasuk Samach. Vayivorachu es Rivka vayomer lah. So who gives the bracha? Lavan and the mother. They're all that's left. Whatever happened to Besuel, he expired the night before. Because, as the Rashi tells us, and we don't hear from him anymore, because they wanted to kill Eliezer. I mean, Shidduchim aside, Eliezer had money, and they thought better for the quick gain. So they wanted to kill Eliezer, therefore they poisoned his food. And Amalek then came and switched the plates, or switched the portion, so that it was Eliezer that ate the poison and died. And that's the justice there. Now that much is well known. But what's very interesting is to raise the question, does Eliezer know this? Does he know that they have put poison in his food? And the Alshi HaKadosh says, it could be that he doesn't know they put poison in his food. But he does know, probably, that the Malach switched. In other words, when they put poison, which presumably he wasn't there, and how would he know? But a Malach came and switched them. So, we know from Hagar that people who are members, veteran members of Avram's household, are versed in the art of spotting Malachim. They know a Malach when it's present. Which means Eliezer became alerted to the situation when the Malach came and switched the plates around. And then it becomes clear to him there's something wrong with the food that was put in front of him. That's very interesting, because that, says the Alshir, is the reason why Eliezer says, I'm not going to eat anything until I've told my story and heard what you have to say. Because he knows that if they eat first, Besuel will not have anything to say to the story. He knows that as soon as they eat, whatever was meant to happen to him will happen to Besuel. And he suspects the worst. But he doesn't want Besuel to eat from the food and expire before he's heard the story and given his blessing. because if they first the su'al dies, that's not the appropriate circumstance to start talking about shidduchim. They'll become preoccupied with other matters, and they'll say, you know, how can we talk about things at a time like this? And therefore, on the contrary, he wants to make use of the su'al while he's still alive, and therefore, no one's eating anything, not him, not the su'al, to the hilt of the story. The su'al says yes. Okay, now the su'al can exit the picture, and that's actually very good timing, because now it's his last wishes is really is to say, you know, give his blessing, makes it harder to reverse. So these are just part of what Eliezer has to deal with if anyone else thinks that shidduchim are troublesome. Now, the bracha that they give him, again, achoseinu, atayi, la'alfei revavo, you should be thousands, you should be tens of thousands, and again, they had mazel. This is the bracha that they say just before going to the chuppah. There is a Masorah, and Masorah, as we've mentioned in the past, is where they ring together certain distinctive words, perhaps words that do not appear that often, and group them. And the point is, and it's a fascinating idea, and you see the Mefarshim are very exacting about this and very, very thorough here, that there becomes a thematic connection between all these places where this distinctive word is mentioned itself. It's really, really fascinating. What's a distinctive word here? The word revava. How many times in the Tanakh do we have the word revava? Well, thankfully, we don't have to count. The Masorah has done it. And the Masorah says, there's four revavas. And here they are. The first is, in this week's parsha, their bracha, achoseinu atayi la'alfei revava. You'll be for thousands and tens of thousands. Very nice. The second is in Parshas Hazinu, ushnayin yonisu revava. Two will give chase to myriads, to 10,000. That's the second revava, shnayim yonisu revava. Third, in Parshas Bechukosai, the brachas for the Jewish people, umeya mikem, revava yodofu. 100 of you will chase 10,000 of them. Umeya mikem, revava yodofu. And the final revava is actually a pasuk that we mention on Seder night, from the Navi Yechezkel. Revava ketzema hasode nesatich. I placed you, revava, 10,000 fold at the foliage of the field, about the profusion, the propagation of Am Yisrael. Now the question is, what is the connection between these four revavas? It'll be like revava, two will chase revava, 100 will chase revava, and revava ketzema hasode. It's also very interesting that the Masorah quotes these psukim out of order. It mentions the pasuk in Hazinu second. Hazinu is the end of the Torah. And then third, it mentions Bechukosai, which is Chumash Vayikra. So clearly, it's aligning them in order to prime us for the message. Says the Al-Sheikh HaKodesh, the Medrash tells us that one of the reasons why Yitzchak and Rivka, it took so long for them to have children, they were married for 20 years, is because of this bracha. In other words, Lavan gave him this amazing bracha, and he shouldn't claim the credit as if to say, yes, the Jewish people, it's all thanks to me, I gave him a bracha, and he actually acted as a deterrent for that bracha to be, for them to have children, so it shouldn't have anything to do with him. Until Yitzchak, through supreme tefillah, was able to put them back on track to have children. That's what the Medrash said. Very interesting. That the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh, that concept is alluded to with the Masorah of these four revavas. The first revava is the bracha, which is where it all starts. Achoseinu atayi la'afei revava. Okay, but as we know, because he gave the bracha, and who gave the bracha? Lavan and his mother, them giving the bracha actually acted as a prevention from it coming true. And that's the second revava, which says, ushnayim yonisu revava. Two will banish revava. Those two, Lavan and his, distanced the revava of the that they mentioned in the bracha from happening. It was only reclaimed by Yitzchak, and that's the third Masorah of revava. Umeyamikem revava yirdofu. The two of them shooed it away. Yitzchak had to pursue after it. And Yitzchak is called Mea Mikem because the number 100 is very significant. He is the Ben Mea. He was the one born when Abram was 100. And Mea Mikem, two of them chased it away. The Mea, that's Yitzchak, from you, Revah Yodopi, he's got to now pursue the Revava in order to reclaim it, which he successfully did through his tefillahs, which then became fulfilled as the pasuk says, "Ruvava ketzemach hasadeh mesatich." So that's a very wonderful perush of the Masoreh. We see the Mefarshim alert to all the wavelengths upon which the Torah is transmitting, from the very basic pshat discussions to the world of remet and everything in between. We'll leave it over there.